afternoon. I'm opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. It is February 15th, 2017. Today is a public hearing with public testimony on House Bill 5029, Border Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Ms. Teresa, take it away.
Okay. Good afternoon, members of the committee. This will be fairly brief. So the Border Parole and Post-Prison Supervision is a primarily general fund financed agency. It has just a very small amount of other funds. As such, falls into that category of a budget that gets looked at quite closely. But if you look at the budget over time, the real issue that kind of pops out at people is the difference between actually their 2013-15 budget and where we are today. And that is really due to the increase in responsibility for the board that came out of legislation both in 2013 and 15 regarding the sex offender notification levels program. And the board will be talking to you about that and what that workload means. As you look at the difference between the legislatively approved and the current service level, that really is just the biennialization of position costs and roll up there. And to the governor's budget, the difference is you see kind of this increase of three positions, but if you will look, those were in the 15-17 budget. They were limited duration, so in current service level they come out and in fact they go back in. Now it's not a rule to do this, but if you were to apply the reduction, percentage reduction for the public safety program that was in the co-chair's existing budget framework, that would be a 3.1% reduction. That would come about to about $270,000, just for context. Again, there's no rules about that, but we like to make sure you know that's there. So again, the primary driver here is the is those additional program costs. And I think the one thing, as the board will talk to you about and that you want to keep in mind, is that even at the current service level in the governor's budget, as that program has ramped up, even at that level, we are not able, the board is not able to meet the deadlines that currently exist in statute. And they'll talk more about that, but that's probably the big policy issue in this agency. And then finally, the board does have one piece of legislation, Senate Bill 24, that was introduced at their request, which is a bill that extends the time frame for a risk assessment to be completed. That bill is assigned to Senate Judiciary. With that, unless there are questions, we can move to the next item.
Chair Wu.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Winters, Chair Stark, other members of the Joint Committee. My name is Michael Wu. I am the Chair of the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Thank you for the opportunity to give public testimony on this bill. With me, seated to my right, is Executive Director of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, Brenda Carney. We will be splitting responsibility for the presentation today. Also from the board in the room behind me is Board Vice Chair Christine Herman. If there are questions from the committee that are in areas where she's more familiar with, I may turn to her for some of those answers. We would like to start with the board's missions and goals. Our mission is to protect the public and reduce the risk of repeat criminal behavior through incarceration and community supervision decisions, and this based on all applicable laws, victims' interests, public safety, and recognized principles of offender behavior change. We are trying to improve the success and safety of incarceration to community transition through evidence-based decisions and supervision and intervention methods. First of the next two slides, I like to think of as the first slide is really a breakdown of what has traditionally been the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision's primary business and primary function in community safety in Oregon. That really is our function in the criminal justice system as an agency where we still have authority over inmates to release them onto parole, and also setting release conditions for inmates releasing from the Department of Corrections, and then interfacing with their supervision, interfacing with community corrections when they are sanctioning and requesting warrants in their supervision. So this slide just lays out a little bit of our role in conjunction and our place in relation to the Department of Corrections and community corrections. Obviously, Department of Corrections has control over inmates while they are committed to the institutions. Many of them, the vast majority of them now, are released because they have determinate sentences. They are not subject to parole release. In other words, they're not subject to a decision by the parole board about whether or not they should be released or not.
What are those percentages between those that are determinate and those that you still have responsibility for?
We have that on a future slide.
I'll wait till we get there.
Okay. We share some joint responsibility with the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections in this. And this has traditionally been the work most people think about when they think about the parole board, is parole hearings, the parole board going to a prison, speaking with an inmate, speaking with inmate advocates, speaking with victim advocates about the decision about whether or not the criteria has been met for release. The next slide is a representation of our new work. This is the work that's been driven by legislative fiscal officer has referenced, has been really been the driver in our budget the last few years, which is sex offender classification, sex offender notification, and leveling. This is new work for us. It's only been going on since 2014.
2015.
And we are, as it started out, we were one of three agencies that were involved in the classifications, Department of Corrections, County Community Corrections, and the board. Department of Corrections was taken out in the last bill to address this. We are now the primary agency responsible for those assessments and classifications on the sex offender registry. As a result, we are now working with some familiar community partners, victims groups, community corrections, Department of Corrections. We are working with some new partners who we've had to build relationships with, especially Oregon State Police, as they are the keeper of the registry. So we have been working very hard on building a relationship with that agency. We are authorized in statute. The statute allows for five members appointed to four-year terms by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Board members per governor policy cannot serve more than two consecutive terms. The board is currently composed of 28 full-time employees. That includes the five board members, the executive director, a supervising executive assistant, and 21 support staff. As this slide illustrates, it's really been the legislation creating the sex offender assessment and classification system that has led to the increases in our full-time employee staffing. When the changes were made to remove Department of Corrections from the assessment and classification process, we absorbed some of those responsibilities, and we were given funding to hire people to implement that, and that's what's really driven that stark increase there. And this just laid out our, I guess, Brennan, I'm going to get the phrasing wrong, so maybe you can help me out here.
So this covers the history of the board's budget, just showing what the legislatively approved budgets have been over the last, looking at the last 10 years, and the significant jump from 2013-15 to the 2015-17 budgets, and that was driven by the funding for the new program.
We are almost entirely funded by the general fund. We do have a small amount of revenue that comes through records requests, copying and providing records, but it's a very, very small fraction of our.
A question, because you're showing your LAB from 2005-15 and going up to 2023, is the assumption there, because you know your population is not the determinant population, it's the other population that you have, is that because you're talking about the sexual risk assessments that's driving that upward, or what's?
So when I did the estimates, that is based on if we were continued at current service level and just with inflation, it would be approximately a 10% increase each biennium. So it wasn't projecting that we would be asking for additional positions or funding for the program. But,
so your inflation figures at 10%?
Approximately, yes. Looking at the different inflation rates that are in the budget.
And Madam Chair, Co-Chair, a lot of that higher rate from what you would think about inflation comes because they are largely driven by personal services costs. So you could, you know, the assumption would change it, but that's why you're going to see a higher inflation rate than if it was an agency that had a higher percentage of S&S.
What percentage of your budget is contracted out? You contract out, you still contract out sociology or physical, those studies? Are you doing them in-house? Psych studies?
All of our psychological evaluations are contracted out, both for the board's work in parole and also on the sex offender classification side.
Yeah. And Co-Chair Winters and Co-Chair Stark, I do have a slide on that in the budget portion, but right off the top, about 8.5% of our budget is for professional services that include those contracting services.
This slide also includes our program priorities. They are not in any particular order or reflect any ranking internal to the board. As I stated before, the first three really are about what has historically been our core work, parole release and community supervision, and everything that goes along with that. As an agency, every time we make a decision about a parolee, that person has the ability to first appeal that decision to us administratively. So we handle our own administrative review in-house. We also deal along with the Department of Justice's help with any legal issues that come out of our decisions. Also writing policies, rules, and operations. One interesting fact about the parole board is that since we have authority over populations that are supervised at the county level, we interact with the county on those individuals, and so our policies are going to have a big impact on how those individuals are supervised. So when we talk about policies, rules, and operations, that's a large portion of it. The sex offender notification levels, as we've discussed, is our newest priority. This slide just breaks down sort of more in averages just what the work looks like. In our sort of core work in parole, release, and post-prison supervision, we conduct actual hearings. That number of 20 a month is an average. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower. It really is driven by a lot of different factors. We do issue every inmate who leaves a Department of Corrections facility, the board has authority to issue the conditions of supervision while they are on post-prison supervision. So this includes any special conditions, not having contact with a victim, paying restitution, things like that. We also, for the individuals who are under our authority, if as they are being supervised by community corrections, if there's a belief that they are in violation of those supervision conditions and they are under our authority, those supervisory officers apply to the parole board to have warrants issued for their arrest in violation of those conditions. Same thing, again, on the back end of that, we also, when we have individuals under our authority, we are the sanctioning authority. That can include jail time, other sanctions as well. But we review those sanctions as requested by the supervisory officers. For our populations who are still under the old matrix system of sentencing, not under sentencing guidelines, many of them were entitled by rule and by law to potentially be discharged from supervision earlier. So we are the agency with that authority. We review those requests as they come in to determine whether or not the standard has been met for early discharge. Morrissey hearings refer to the violation hearings when an individual has been on supervision, has been alleged to have violated the terms of their supervision. They're entitled to due process. The case that had helped establish that is the Morrissey case. The hearings, which were then enacted to make sure that those due process rights were vindicated, are just titled Morrissey hearings. The board has one full-time hearings officer who does those some of those hearings. Some counties do their own. And we do the rest. We also, to comport with victims' rights statutes, employ a victim specialist to make notifications and also to help provide victim services through our processes. Finally, and we'll have more slides on this later, we are now obviously assessing and classifying sex offenders. I think I covered administrative review and some of these others. As to the sex offender notification levels, the registry, as maintained by the Oregon State Police, is being every registrant on that registry is being assessed for risk through the legislation. There are two populations. There are those who are adult males. They are being assessed through an instrument known as the Static 99R. It is an actuarially based risk assessment tool. It's widely used around the world. It's been used in some form in Oregon since 2004. It was adopted because through the work of a stakeholder work group. As
Senator Fredericks has a question.
I do, and I want to make sure that I'm trying to understand this. I have been dealing with a number of folks who tell me that once people are discharged, they are charged a fee for seeing their probation and parole folks. Is that correct?
Senator Fredericks, I'm not aware of any fee that the parole board would have authority over. When we're talking about discharge, we mean that they are discharged from supervision, so they should not be seeing their supervisory officer on that case anymore. I don't know if Ms.
Senator Frederick, excuse me, and co-chairs, in my experience, there may be some confusion about what fee they're being charged when they're discharged from supervision. While they're on supervision, they pay a fee to community corrections. However, when they're discharged, if they're a registered sex offender, they are then required to pay an annual fee to register.
This is not for sexual offender thing, but there is a fee while they're on supervision.
Yes.
They are being paid. They're paying a fee for that.
Correct.
And how much is that fee generally?
Senator Frederick, co-chairs, each county establishes their own.
Okay.
But from my recollection, it can be anywhere from $35 to $45 a month.
So let me make sure that I understand this correctly. You've been discharged. You've been released. You're still under supervision. But you're being charged a fee for seeing your supervisor or your probation person.
Correct.
If you are having struggles to get a job, where do you get the money to pay that fee?
Senator Frederick and co-chairs, members of the committee, so that is that's outside the authorization of the board. However, the counties can determine that by staffing that with the client and the PO to determine whether they waive the fee completely or if they reduce it or if they can take care of their fees another way.
Can you give me an idea of the range of the fees again? How much does that usually end up being? Do you have any sense?
From my recollection, it's anywhere from $35 to around $45 per month.
And Senator Fredericks, when we have DOC and parole and probation come in, I think those are questions that we can
okay.
ask
I just wanted
them.
To make sure that I was clear.
Because there's two, and I'm going to go to co-chair Stark now because he had a comment or questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Just back on the Static 99R, I'm curious, how long does that assessment take to complete?
Co-Chair Stark, that's a good question. It varies depending on a number of different factors. The main one is how good of a contact do we have with the person that we are assessing? Also, what will also determine that is how old are the documents that we are using for that assessment. Also, if the documents we need are coming from out of state, these are all factors which can make the process longer. It's difficult to put an actual average number on it.
Can you give me a range? And the reason I'm asking is in researching this, I found one research paper by a PhD. Now, from the site, obviously, they were not a fan of the Static 99. where they were saying that it only took about 30 minutes to do one of these assessments, and which doesn't seem right, but based off the numbers and LFO reports, it shows that these are averaging 14.8 hours per assessment. And I'm trying to, you know, is there an actual range that you guys can say, oh yeah, it's 4 to 6 hours or 2 to 3 hours, or how much time goes into one assessment?
Co-chair, sorry, there's no way to give a per hour estimate like that. I think the way to think about it is that in an ideal situation, if an individual, the way the static was designed was to be done in person with the individual being assessed. So if the assessor had access to all the relevant documents and the person sitting in front of them, it could very well be something like 30 minutes. We are not in that position when we're doing our assessment. We are relying on documents and questionnaires being sent to the person being assessed. So while the actual time it might take to fill out and complete the assessment might be shorter, our time periods are longer because we are including the time it takes us to gather all the relevant documentation and materials.
Follow up. I have more questions on this.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I think they're going to talk about Static 99 more. Are you talking about it more in your presentation in a few minutes, a little bit, or?
I think this would actually be a good time to answer these questions.
So I'm the individuals that you guys have performing these. So I'm trying to look at the cost of these. And when I look at the cost, it seems like a lot of time and a lot of money. And based off of the numbers that were put forward, $3.2 million per biennium. Thanks for pointing that out earlier, Rick Sanchez. You know, which for 10 FTE breaks down to roughly $160,000 per position with benefits and everything that we're putting into it, at an average of 11.7 of these per month, at an average of 14.8 hours per assessment, we're paying over $1,100 per assessment. And that, to me, seems excessive. When you look at the website from the creators of the Static 99, and in their Q&A, you know, section, they go into whether or not you have to have, you know, higher education levels to perform these assessments, and they're very clear that you don't. So I'm trying to figure out why we're paying $160,000 per position, $1,100 per assessment. That all just seems very excessive to me. So maybe you can help me understand that whole process and how long it takes and what the salary range is and who does them and what credentials and that sort of thing.
Coach Sark, that's an astute question. I'll turn to the executive director maybe for the breakdown on the salary ranges and so forth. As to the process, much of this is rooted into the project itself, which is the first legislation and the subsequent legislation was to tackle the project of how do we assess using evidence-based practices the 29,000 people on the registry. The work group that was assembled decided that the Static 99R was going to be the most efficient model for that. As you've pointed out, other evaluation techniques, which might require somebody with a PhD or higher licensing, would be a major cost factor there. The Static 99R does not require those types of credentials. However, the Static 99R is still an instrument which requires training, and it still requires experience. There are a number of different nuances. The coding manual itself is not. I don't want to oversell it, but you have to dig into the coding manual in order to get the validity out of it that it's meant to produce. So that's my backhanded way of saying that the process does involve a degree of training and a degree of familiarity. We are obviously not where we want to be in terms of efficiency. We are hoping as time goes by that we are making the right decisions to increase that efficiency, so the numbers which you are talking about come down on a per cost basis. In terms of the time factor, though, the one thing I would like to stress is that so much of the static is going to go to being able to substantiate and answer certain questions about the crime itself, the offense itself, the types of victims, how many victims, how many convictions, the timing of that. As we do these assessments for people who have been on the registry since starting in 1989, those are historical records, which require, it's more of a research project. It requires us to not only procure the records, but then to go through the records. So the time factor is elongating that and making, and I think compounding the efficiency point that you're making. But as to your point that we need to be more efficient, absolutely, and we are looking at a number of different ideas about how to not reinvent the wheel and how to be more efficient through this process.
You have any?
And hey, can you comment on what the salary ranges are of those performing those assessments?
excuse me, Co-Chair Stark. I don't have the exact numbers. However, it is at a level of an administrative specialist 2, which I can guess around $180,000. That's including the salary and all of the benefits that are included with that.
Biennial.
For biennial.
It'd be 90.
I apologize. Yeah. Not okay. Per
month.
Or per year.
Divided by 2.
He's getting out of job application.
We'd love to.
Sorry, one last on that.
Okay.
So can you please double check on those numbers? Because the math, and I'm assuming there are other expenses, but the straight math from the amount, you know, we allotted for it, the number of FTEs breaks down to $160,000 per position as opposed to $90,000 per position. And I'm talking annually, not biannually.
Yes.
So would love to see that. It's a world I'm quite familiar with. I do a lot of work in the mental health world. My wife is a mental health professional, and so we kind of know those what the going rate is, and that's why I'm surprised mm-hmm. by it. So, thank you.
Just to follow along the question, did you look at, since you said, you know, the beginning, you know, you've got you have to collect some information and data and that kind of research. Two things. Did you look at perhaps contracting out for that kind of thing, for that kind of services in the beginning? And did you really look at those positions based on what the actual skill level is needed in order to go forward? You know, I'm with kind of Co-Chair Stark. You know, we're looking at some levels. If I look at what's required, whether or not you need that level or not, and I don't know, you'll have to tell me. But did you look at maybe contracting out for that research capacity that you were talking about, or information gathering capacity?
Co-Chair Winters, we did not look at contracting out parts of the process at one point. We did look at contracting out the entire process. I'm embarrassed to say we did not think about subcontracting on a piece of that, so I wouldn't be able to answer as to what that cost would be. As to the second question about the as to how the I guess requirement levels were decided upon for this position, I'm going to have to ask the executive director about that, since that predates my involvement in the hiring.
Right, Co-Chair Winters and Co-Chair Stark. At the beginning of the process, when we were developing the position descriptions, we worked with HR, and we looked at the duties that we would be having the assessment specialist do. And based on those duties, the level of responsibility, the need for someone to not only understand how to read statute and rule and apply it, we needed them to have a certain level of, authority to work the assessments without constant supervision. They're at a level that they do not need the micromanaging. I guess that's the best way I can think of it. They work on their own, basically, unless there is an issue that
which
is
begs reported. Another question: are they working physically out of the building where you're located, or can they work from home?
co-chair Winters, they are working at the office.
They're working at the
office.
They
do not telecommute.
They don't. Yes, Representative Huffman.
I'm just going to interject this while we're on the topic of positions. And so you're fairly small staff, but do you have any unfilled positions?
We currently have, Representative Huffman, we do have two unfilled positions. One is the fifth board member position. That's been unfilled since March of 2016.
Yes.
And our receptionist position is unfilled. Mm-hmm.
Follow up.
How long has the receptionist position been unfilled?
Excuse me. Representative Huffman, it was vacant for probably, I want to say about 8 months. We currently have a temporary person working in that position, and she's been there since December.
And Co-Chair Winters, if I could address one of your questions about could the assessment specialist potentially work from home? One issue that we faced is that the records that the assessment specialists do need to access, many of them are through the LEDS system, and we have to maintain compliance with our LEDS license, which for physical records. Would be a complication there.
So let me understand, because you're talking about some face-to-face activity as well as the review of LEDS, correct?
Co-Chair Winters, no.
No,
For the adult male population, which the static 99R is going to be used for, it is entirely a paper process.
Okay, but not all of it is entirely paper.
For the static 99Rs, which are being used for the adult male process, it is entirely paper.
Okay.
For women who are required to register, for juveniles convicted as adults.
Is that paper also?
That evaluation process, because the static 99 is not normed for them, will be an in-person evaluation. So face-to-face using the subcontractors we talked about earlier.
And I'm assuming that the population for the women is a lot smaller than it is for the population for the men.
It's significantly smaller. I believe it's under 3,000.
Co-Chair Winters, for the female population, it's right around 1,000, maybe even a little less.
And with the other juveniles and such, it's about 2,500 is what mm-hmm. the vice chair is telling me. Mm-hmm. So significantly less than the...
So is your plan to actually prioritize... this population so that you're getting the hire first? Or how are you planning to do your prioritization?
Co-Chair Winters, as of right now, our prioritization has been focusing on those who have been designated as predatory sex offenders. There are, I think, a little over 2,000 of those individuals with that designation. These are the individuals who are eligible to be put on OSP's public website. So we are focusing right now of our assessment specialists. One is on leave. Five of the remaining are focusing on the predatory population. And this slide.
You get on leave and you just started.
Excuse me?
Never mind. Never mind. Go ahead. Continue.
This slide, Co-Chair Winters, will probably have an answer to one of your earlier questions about some of the statistics about who falls under whose authority. There are currently still, under our authority, 370 matrix offenders. These are the individuals who were sentenced under the state's matrix sentencing program instead of the current sentencing guideline system. We also have authority over all inmates who've been sentenced pursuant to the dangerous offender statutes. There are 140 currently. We also have release authority over those individuals convicted of murder or aggravated murder when their sentence contemplates the possibility of parole. So in other words, not a true life sentence. We must apply the law that was in effect at the time of the offense crime. So we do some legal time travel and apply what was in effect at the time the inmate committed their crime. All told, out of Department of Corrections population, it is approximately 8% of the population that we still have release authority over.
So of your 8%, or your 1,200, what is the age range? Because I suspect that your population is quite a bit older. And I think we've had this conversation before. What is the medical condition of most of your population?
Co-Chair Winters, I don't have a statistic for you. I can find you a statistic for the age breakdown.
I think we had it once before that generally most of your population and the chronologically advantaged group or the older age are pretty much most of them are sex offenders and the murder population.
Co-Chair Winters, anecdotally, I think you're correct that given the length of the sentences that the parole board deals with, dangerous offender sentences go up to 30 years. Life sentences in case of murders and aggravated murders, that's probably a fair assumption. We can find a direct figure for you, though.
You might have those figures. Do you have those?
Okay.
I know it's so, pretty substantial, most of them.
I'd like to just ask briefly, so I don't want to put you in the middle of a policy discussion, but there is a bill that's proposing to add some crimes to sex offender registration, and I'm hearing from people saying that we should be looking at the risk rather than moving people onto the registry just by crimes. Would you agree with that, or you think, I believe they have to do with the soliciting prostitution, so they'd want them to show up on the sex offender list? You already got a lot of people on that list.
Well, Representative Barker, I appreciate you not wanting to put me in the middle of a policy debate. I'd appreciate not being there too.
Okay.
But
that's fine.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah.
would you continue, Chair Wu?
In addition, we were discussing the board's work. We still have supervisory authority, though, not release authority, whether or not you will get out of prison or not, but supervisory authority of individuals sentenced under the sentencing guidelines releasing from the Department of Corrections. There are over 14,500 of those individuals, so that does make up a large portion of that population. This slide, we've covered some of the details, but I know there's a lot of interest, obviously, in the board's work on sex offender classification. The current registry, as it stands, is approximately 27,000 individuals with a requirement to register on the registry. The original bill spread the assessing between three different groups. The Board of Parole was going to be one group who would assess. Department of Corrections would assess those leaving their custody, and Community Corrections would assess those on probation or local supervision. In its most recent incarnation, Department of Corrections was taken out of that equation, and it just left the Board of Parole and Community Corrections, and the board assumed the majority of responsibility for those assessments. Currently, we're in a period of a bit of a hybrid system right now with the Sex Offender Registry. As we assess and classify people, we transmit, per the statute, the Oregon State Police, those classifications, and they are being added to the registry. But the current registry continues. Parts of the statute also contemplated a path for reclassification and potentially relief for certain groups. Those hearings are not to begin unless either everybody has been classified on the registry or until January 1, 2019. So we are not going to classify everybody by that deadline. So it will be at that deadline when the individuals who have the classifications and meet the other statutory requirements may begin to petition for relief or reclassification. That there is a significant number of individuals on the registry. We think about 6,500 who, if they had a classification by 2019, would meet some of those other statutory requirements to be able to petition for reclassification and relief. At that point, the board would begin having hearings for relief, whether or not we would relieve an individual of the obligation to continue to register or reclassify an individual because their risk had changed, either high, medium, or low. This is our current table of organization. As you can see, the fifth board member position is currently vacant. We have the executive director along with a supervising executive assistant. The executive director directly manages our hearings officers. One of them, as I stated, was a revocation hearings officer who deals with supervision. The other two are dealing with individuals who object to their classification on the sex offender tiering. And also will in 2019 begin to hear the hearings along with the board member about whether or not somebody should be reclassified or have relief for registration. The other staff report to our executive assistant and then that's where the new hires for the Sex Offender Project are located. Our performance.
How much time does it take you to prepare and ahead of time for a hearing?
Co-Chair Winters, do you mean a parole hearing to mm-hmm. release somebody? It does take quite a bit of time. There is quite a bit of documentation that we routinely submit, and that inmates also submit on their own behalf. So it can take anywhere from, I would say, the shortest period of time would probably be 2 to 3 hours. The longest would be 5 or 6, maybe even a little bit more, depending.
I'm trying to calculate the number of cases that you have monthly and looking at how much time it is to prepare those cases. And I know just trying to look at workflow on that. And do you also reach in now and do interface work with DOC on your parole hearings or not?
Co-Chair Winters, it would help me to know what you mean by
there was this conversation years ago that it wasn't important if you received a report from the Department of Corrections with respect to whether or not the person was a good person, not so good person, whether or not do you do that now or not?
We do not, Co-Chair Winters, we do not proactively ask Department of Corrections to prepare that report. The one caveat there is dangerous offenders by statute. DOC has to prepare us a report with certain factors listed out, which covers some of that area.
But you do, however, there's receive the report from the psychologist and what have you, and that's a part of also the decision-making process. Is that not accurate?
Co-Chair Winters, yes. In exit interviews for individuals leaving, potentially to leave to be paroled, we have psychological evaluations.
It's not used to determine whether or not the parole is granted or not?
It's one of the pieces of evidence we look at to determine whether or not the legal standard has been met.
Because there used to be, and I don't know if there still is because I haven't heard anything from anybody inside the institution, there used to be a real issue concerning whether or not the psychologists understand the nuances and the culture of minorities inside the institution and the prison. and sometimes the psychological recommendation that came from the psychologist with not having a total understanding of the cultural and the behaviors of some minority groups skewed the those recommendations. And like I said, I used to get quite a few of those several years ago, and I haven't had any lately, so it tells me that perhaps that's no longer an issue in the reporting.
Well, Chairman, I hope it's not an issue.
But it used to be a big issue.
And I can understand, why.
Yeah.
This slide details, the next few slides will detail some of our key performance measures. Overall, we believe we are meeting or we are within targets on this. We are especially happy to report that we are for the first time meeting our target in terms of administrative review. As I stated earlier, every board decision or act that affects somebody under our authority first has to be taken up on administrative appeal to us before that person can then seek appeal to the courts. We are now right at about 60 days between time of the time of the filing of that with us to when we are acting on it, and that is a large improvement for us. These are other key performance measures. I can go into them in more detail. I would just note the parole recidivism. We are still using the older definition of recidivism, not the new one that's more commonly in place, and that has come to our attention, and we will take steps to
update
that.
When do you plan to adopt the one that we adopted for the 3194?
As soon as we can.
Co-Chair Winters, we plan to make a request to change that KPM for next year's report.
Because it makes consistency nice.
It does. And we were, once we realized that oversight, we wanted to correct it for that reason. And this slide addresses recidivism, again, using the old definition. Executive Director Carney mentioned that we were looking to make some changes to one of our key performance measures. That was on victim notification. The current key performance measure, we felt in practice, wasn't really doing a very accurate job of reflecting on how we were doing with victim interaction. The old performance measure simply measured the percentage of active registered victims for which the board had an accurate point of contact for notifications of hearings and of offenders' release. Basically, did we have a good address or not? That simply did not capture what we aspire to in terms of victim service. So we are proposing to change that to percentage of notifications which are actually sent to a registered victim within a reasonable time frame, so they have a good notice so that they can decide what they want to do before any hearing conducted by the board. It would actually measure our interaction and how well we were servicing.
So I'm asking, I'm assuming something here that, so probably a lot of them you can't get a hold of. These are people who have been in prison for a long time and the victims have died or moved away, or is that you lose contact with them, or do they stay registered?
Representative Barker, there are a number of different reasons why the addresses might go bad. People may have registered with the board, as you say, 20 years ago, and have decided not to update with us for a number of different reasons. Sometimes on purpose, sometimes not. Or in some cases, yes, some victims have passed away.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, and members of the committee, I will be covering the budget portion of the presentation this afternoon. So this slide, as you can see, the majority of our budget at this time is driven by personal services, which is just over $6 million. Historically, our Attorney General funding had made up nearly 25% of our budget. However, while that's now been reduced, there is an increase in our professional services. And as mentioned before, that increase is due primarily with the funding provided for the sex offender evaluations, the interagency agreements with community corrections, and various other services such as the inmate legal services, transcription, and translator services for hearings.
Oops, that's not gonna work, is it? I've just
roll. There we go.
Are you having less lawsuits? Is that why the AG's office is?
Co-chair Winters, I wish I could say that it was because we are having less lawsuits. I think it's because some of the work that the Department of Justice used to do for us, the board decided to take that on internally.
Okay. You have more attorneys on the board, too, now, don't you?
We have, in addition to myself and the vice chair, our policy analyst is also a licensed member of the bar.
For program changes, the only major program change for the board in the last 6 years has been the implementation of House Bill 2549 in 2013 and House Bill 2320 in 2015, and that was for the sex offender notification level system. That system classifies registered sex offenders to a community notification level based on their risk to sexually reoffend. The impacts for the board have included developing and implementing new administrative rules and new processes for the program. There's been revisions to multiple other administrative rules, and of course, the significant increase in staff. And to go along with the staff increase, there were delays in recruitment and the training of the new program staff. When looking at contracts, we did research for assessment data and evidence-based practices so that we could procure contracts with qualified providers to conduct the sex offender evaluations. And another impact was due to the increase in staff, we needed to locate and secure additional office space to house all of the new program staff. Initially, House Bill 2549 included the Department of Corrections as a classifying agency, which Chair Wu mentioned earlier. And they would be responsible for those registrants who were currently serving a sentence for specific sex crimes and would be releasing after January 1st, 2014. With House Bill 2320 in 2015, it shifted that responsibility to the board and resulted in a backlog of a little over 1,000 registrants between January 1, 2014 and January 1, 2015 when the House bill passed. With regard to environmental factors, as legislation changes, the board faces increases in workload as well as statutory requirements, and that was primarily with the new sex offender notification system. And with those changes, in the past, the board has typically been funded at current service level or sometimes below. Although some authority for community supervision has been shifted to community corrections, as inmate and supervised offender numbers increase, so do the duties of the board members and the staff. And Chair Wu explained some of those duties. For example, when there's an increase in prison population, there's an increase in the development of release planning and supervision orders. And there's also, if there's an increase in warrants, that equals a longer supervision period for those offenders on supervision because their time stops when there's an active warrant and they will not expire. Any case law that requires a change in the board's policy or the functional program duties, it increases legal costs and potentially increases the cost to provide or obtain specific services. With regard to victim and stakeholder participation, board hearings are typically the most traumatic times at which the board provides services to victims. However, when victims are registered with the board, we identify them and we notify them during multiple phases of the inmates or offender cycle with the board. Victims have an opportunity to review release plans as well as conditions of supervision and provide input or feedback. We assist with creating safety plans with the victims and/or their families. And we provide community resource information for once the offender is released into the community. And as with any biennial change, the board has experienced various changes in funding and staffing levels. And as mentioned, while we generally receive current service level or cuts to our budget, the 2015-17 biennium provided the additional funding for staffing and for the new sex offender notification program.
Can I ask a budget question? Because I'm looking at your at the budget summary for your 15-17, and one of it says that you were given $3,163,000 to establish 12 positions or 10 FTE, and you say you have seven? How many for sexual offenders assessment?
Co-Chair Winters, so the breakdown, so I'll try to remember this off the top of my head. So there were 12 positions overall. There was there were five assessment specialist positions, three of which were limited duration. Two hearings officers specific to the sex offender notification program, another hearing specialist, which is for the sex offender program. We included the policy analyst and the fifth board member.
Fourth and fifth.
Am I missing?
Was it the fourth and fifth?
The fourth and fifth. Sorry, yes, the fourth and fifth board members.
And all of that was out of the over $3 million allocation?
Yes. Co-Chair Winters, that also includes not just the salaries and the benefits, but also the the startup costs, which are then phased out.
Because your $420,000 for space and moving and all of that is separate from that figure.
Correct, Co-Chair Winters. For the rent, which I have a slide on that later, but the rent was a smaller portion because we did not actually get moved until January of 2016. And then, of course, moving and furniture and getting the networking, all of those costs were included with that. Okay. For our agency efforts for cost savings, by sharing the bulk of our administrative and IT services with the Department of Corrections, the board has maintained cost savings in this area for well over 15 years. And although the board does not have a formal contract with Department of Corrections for these services, we have generally distributed funds at the end of each biennium, if those funds are available, to offset some of the cost of the services that they provide. As we move toward more frequent use of electronic processes, we plan to see additional reductions in the cost of paper, filing, and archival. Based on the similar sized agencies, the board has estimated a cost savings of over $200,000 per year through the shared resources with Department of Corrections. And as we go forward, we look to save over $15,000 more per year on the cost of paper and classification folders alone as we move forward with an electronic document storage and archival process. And as noted, just in the processes that we've been able to make electronic, we have saved over 49% of a prior budget on paper usage.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
So, and I'm curious about the backup. So, you know, they keep talking about the big earthquake, which I'm hoping to not be living when that occurs. But obviously these files would be so, well, like so many others. And at one point, the state had a server over in Bend, mm-hmm. which would be relatively safe from the flooding, and well, maybe not the flooding over there this year, but. So we have a very good backup for these, all this system?
Representative Barker and Co-Chair Winters, I'm currently in the process of working with Secretary of State to implement the Oregon Records Management System, which I want to say it's in Baker. The backup is in Baker. However, we have an extraordinary amount of paper files, not just with Secretary of State in our archives, but in our records room alone. We estimated close to 30,000 paper files because we retain the files for so long, basically from the moment someone comes into the institution until they are off supervision, and then it goes to archives. So we really have those for a long time. And I don't know how far we would get in creating electronic files for the current folders that we have, but at least starting at one point and starting forward, that would make a huge difference.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
Have we ever thought if the person is deceased, why we need to continue to have files?
Co-Chair Winters,
we keep everything infinitum, and it just seems to me if the person or persons are deceased, why are we keeping the storage alone?
There's some public records laws.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, why?
Right.
If that question has not been asked under, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Winters, I know that this was actually something that came up in the Secretary of State audit last year, or was it 2015? My goodness. We had the audit, and we looked over the retention schedules, and actually for our offender files, once they're off supervision, they are actually retained for 25 years after the end of supervision. And while many of the folks have passed on, we actually, about 6 months ago, had someone, I believe it was a victim's family, come and ask us for files from the offender's file, who the offender had been deceased as well. But it was from 1970. The crime was in the 1970s, but of course the file was held 25 years after he was discharged from parole. And we had to go and look it up on microfiche.
But from a, I'm not talking about one incident, mm-hmm. I'm talking overall. And I used to do records when I was at the med school. I mean, the file retention, if you keep them forever mm-hmm. and ever, and one of the issues that we're dealing with in reentry, and it is on records, and the whole issue of the scarlet letter that never goes away. And so in this case, if they're dead, I mean, if they're deceased, I'm trying to figure out why we need the information. They're not out there committing another crime. It doesn't help us in the prosecutorial piece of it. It's just a question in my mind as to why we have dead records.
Right. And Co-Chair Winters, I think that that's something we can definitely look at as a retention.
I think we
schedule.
Talked to Secretary of State and under the public records law, right. But it's just an interesting question.
Yes, and part of it, we definitely get notice of someone's death when they are on supervision or, of course, in the institution. But once someone is off supervision, there's not really anyone who's, I guess, has an interest in letting us know that someone has
And we're
has
trying
died.
To save all these trees and everything else.
We have a forest in our file room.
Not a good one.
Okay. With policy option packages, the board has two packages in the governor's budget. Package 101 approves a reclassification for our victim specialist and a hearing specialist, which were approved by DAS in 2015. And this package had no fiscal impact for the board. Package 102 establishes three permanent administrative specialist positions to be filled as assessment specialists for the sex offender notification program. And this is basically reintroducing the limited duration positions that we have now as permanent.
A question, do you ever expect that project to be completed?
Co-chair winners? That's a loaded question.
Well.
and co-chair winners, that's a fair question.
Yes.
And right now we're looking at whatever outside the box options we can present that will still maintain fidelity to the spirit of the legislation to show a sustainable path to completing it.
It's a good question.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
So, on that note, I asked around, and DOC, when they do those assessments, now, to my understanding, they have the inmate there, though, so they don't have the research that you guys have to go through, but it takes them approximately 3 hours for those assessments and versus the 14.8 hours.
Well, the question is, why did they stop doing
it? So, have to find a way to make it faster.
Okay, with historical versus projected spending, as you can see, expenditures for our medical services, which is the forensic psychological evaluations, has generally exceeded biennial funding. However, we are on target for the 17-19 biennium, and the projections are based on approximately 140 evaluations that are expected to be completed, and we are increasing the evaluation amount to $1,500 per evaluation versus the current $850.
Because
the $1,500 is more in line with the cost in the community. I did poll the provider community. And this was done prior to the current RFP. And unfortunately, even when we raised the stipend from 425, which was less than 25% of the community rate, we still did not get the amount of providers interested that we were really hoping for. And that was, in part, their feedback was that the amount of work that goes into the psychological evaluations and the risk that they take, because many of the inmates are very litigious, it wasn't worth it for them to be only paid $850. So we maintained the providers that we've had for several years. And
what's your turnover rate among your providers?
There has not been. We've had the same providers for, oh my goodness, I'd have to get back to you on the amount.
So you're not experiencing a turnover rate.
No. And unfortunately, we did have one of the five that we've consistently had officially retire this last year. So we are down to three evaluators. I am confident that with the increase to $1,500.
Are you going to lose any? Are you planning on losing any of your providers?
With a new contract?
If they don't get the contract.
Coach,
they don't get the new contract.
Coach, we haven't heard anything from our remaining contractors that any of them are thinking about leaving. However, they have been working with us for quite a while, and they are coming to the time of their career where retirement is perfectly reasonable. Yeah.
And as you know, this budget cycle is not going to be an easy budget cycle. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, so I'm asking you the budgetary hard questions. and hope that you also ask yourself the budgetary hard questions. So, and with that, Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. So on that, I'm curious what credentialing levels are required again for these psychological evaluators, and what sort of outreach you've done recruitment-wise.
Co-Chair Stark, prior to the RFP that we sent out in 2015, I actually polled the Oregon Board of Psychological or Oregon Psychology Board. I apologize, I can't remember the correct board name. I spoke with them about reaching out to their members and getting interest, also getting more information about what the community cost, what the average community cost that they charged for these forensic evaluations. And that was actually between anywhere between $1,500 up to $2,500. As far as credentials, they do have to be a certified psychologist or psychiatrist in good standing with the Board of Psychology.
And Co-Chair Stark, all our current evaluators for parole hearings, they are psychologists, but with I believe doctorates.
All of them,
yeah, all with doctorates in psychology.
Well, and for the the doctorate level, that standard is that based off of just best practices or a state or federal or legal requirement, or could you have LCSWs or something along those lines doing that work? I look at like the Child Welfare Partnership that Portland State has done with DHS to kind of curb some of their costs and recruit the next generation. I'm just wondering if there are things that you guys can be looking at. But I don't know what these psych evals entail, so it mm-hmm. might require that, but it's worth looking into.
Okay. with regard to facility rent, prior to 2015, the board did not pay rent because it shared space with Department of Corrections at the Dome Building. And as previously noted, the $420,000 that was appropriated in the 15-17 biennium was not just for rent, but included moving costs, setup, etc. The expenditures that I have listed for the 15-17 is solely for the rent that will have been paid. And the projection for 2017-19 is for rent costs only, and that would be for the full biennium. For proposed legislation, the board is tracking several bills and monitoring their status. Most of the proposed legislation has minimal to no effect at the board at this time. However, the board has submitted legislation through Senate Bill 24, which increases the timeline for all classifying agencies to complete their sex offender notification process. Statute currently requires agencies to complete the process within 60 days of the registrant's triggering event to register. But due to delays in obtaining necessary records and ensuring the due process rights are met, we found that 60 days has not been a reasonable period of time. Therefore, the board has requested that timeline be extended to 120 days
to
complete.
Why not 90?
Co-Chair Winters, when we have been working through the process, we were looking that the average time that it has taken to collect the records on some of the historical registrants landed squarely between 90 and 120 days.
Do you think that if you become more efficient and the more knowledgeable and the more processes that you work, then maybe that timeline might be shortened?
Co-Chair Winters, I think that is a reasonable request. And Co-Chair Herman may have some additional information about this, but I would say that in my experience in the startup of this, the biggest time consumption is locating the records for those registrants whose crimes are 15 plus years old, and so many of them are not available, or they've been purged, or they've been put in archive, and trying to find agencies who actually still have the necessary records, that has been the longest time consumption. For the registrants who have the newer convictions, they're more readily available through the courts or the district attorneys or even through community corrections who have the current file, and that timeline isn't as thwarted as it is for those historical registrants.
Think about it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Also in Senate Bill 24, we had asked for language to be changed with regard to the out-of-state registrants. The board does not know when out-of-state registrants actually move into the state, so we've requested that the process timeline for those registrants start at the time that we receive the referral from the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registry. In looking at the 10% reduction worksheet, when considering these reductions, the board has listed as its first program in the standard inflation. While it would reduce some funding and limit some services, it would not cease any program activities. Program two is listed as a reduction in professional services. And that would hinder the board's ability to complete certain statutory duties and maintain the varied contract services, such as the IGAs with community corrections and the sex offender evaluation contracts. Program three is listed as personal services. We had listed that removing our reception position in one FTE would reduce response time to customers and stakeholders, as well as increase a workload for the staff who have to take on those duties from that desk. And the fourth package or program would be a reduction of two of our assessment specialist positions to half-time, and that would further reduce the board's ability to comply with the current duties and deadlines for the sex offender notification program. There was the request to submit a proposed 15% reduction worksheet, and with that, the first two programs, one and two, match what we had listed in the 10%. So standard inflation and professional services as the first two programs. And for personal services, we've added additional positions to be reduced or cut. The reception position is still listed as the one FTE. We would also cut two full assessment specialist positions, which would further inhibit the board's ability to effectively complete the assessments in a timely manner. And the work would be shifted to the remaining staff, which would result in additional delays. There would be a reduction of one hearings officer position to a half-time position, and that would be our Morrissey hearings officer. And that would delay the board's ability to schedule and complete the Morrissey hearings for the offenders who are in custody for violations. And that could potentially lead to legal action if the due process requirements are unmet. And finally, a reduction in the victim services position to half time would reduce services provided to our board registered victims, including assistance with preparing for parole hearings and sex offender notification hearings in the future. For long-term vacancies, we touched on this just a bit earlier. As a small agency, we rarely have vacancies. However, when they do occur, we try to fill them as soon as possible to reduce any impact or disruption in the agency function and the staff workload. The only long-term vacancy the board has had for this biennium is the fifth board member position, which has been vacant due to recruitment difficulty. However, this is anticipated to be filled this spring. And with that, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, we'd be happy to answer any other questions that you'd have at this time.
We're doing good. Thank you.
You asked a lot.
Yeah, we did along the way.
Yeah.
Any comments from, since I see that Brenda's there too.
Well, I will point out that one of the bills that you mentioned is mine, 360. SB 360, and it speaks to the concerns that I started to talk about regarding fines and fees, the idea of allowing people to pay off those fees and fines using community service. Mm-hmm. So,
any additional questions, comments? Do we want to hear from the governor's budget side? I see you're sitting there and you're smiling.
I have a very short presentation. Can you hit the escape button?
Excuse me.
Okay. Let's just do this and do that.
There you go, Ms. Lisper.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and committee members. I'm Michelle Lisper with the Department of DAS, Chief Financial Office. I'm going to be fairly brief. Most of the main issue here and emerging issues have already been discussed. Was the big one was House Bill 2320 from 2015. Right now, based on changes in that law, I'm working with the agency that does exceed existing resources that were not originally that the agency recognized, but they are addressing and assessing those issues. The other one is attracting qualified professional services. At the time I prepared this presentation, obviously the agency is trying to work within their existing budget, current service level, to raise those fees than what was originally allotted at $825. So they don't have a request for additional funding. Apparently, they're estimating less hearings, which allows them to increase the cost for professional service providers. So they are working within their budget from what they just testified. Oops. This chart has already kind of been discussed by your LFO analyst as well as the agency. This is just showing you the 2013-15 actuals versus with the new legislation for the sex offender notification leveling. Their budget was pretty much not quite doubled. And then in 15, in 17-19, you're looking at most of it is attributed in current service level to inflation and working within the same guidelines. There is the, as I will mention, and on my last slide I will, the expenditures, most of it is personal services, as they discussed, 67% of their budget because of the work that they actually do. The items and the investments in the governor's budget are the three assessment specialists. They came in as limited duration, and we would be, our recommendation is to invest and make them permanent so that they can work on the sex offenders from limited duration to permanent positions, seeing as the amount of assessments that at the moment that we're aware of that they would need to do in order to try and meet the statutory deadline of December 2018. And the other adjustments would be statewide adjustments to the price list and governor service charges. And that is all I have as highlight for the governor's budget. If there's any questions.
No questions. Thank you. Any follow-up or anything you'd like to add? Thank you very much. I hope we didn't grill you too much this afternoon. So with that, if there's no further questions, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Say Lou.
Yes.
Could you hit escape
this
for me?
This is when I...
Yes.
Could you hit escape
this
for me?
This is when I... Say, Lou.